second case today is 2011 AP 1514, Richard L. Kimball versus Land Concepts, Inc., etc., or et al., I should say. The lineup is 20 minutes for Attorney Nielsen, 5 minutes for the amicus attorney James Friedman, 30 minutes for David Weber, and 5 minutes for Mr. Nielsen in rebuttal. Agreed? Okay. Mr. Nielsen?
May it please the Court. This Court has accepted review on the petition filed by my client, First American Title, and the question of whether or not the punitive damage award that was given to the Stevensons at trial of $1 million was so grossly excessive as to violate the Wisconsin Constitution and our common law. The compensatory damages, as set by the trial court, were about $29,000. This makes a ratio of 33-1 for the punitive damage award. First American thanks this court for accepting the petition.
Do we use the number that the trial court set, or do we use the jury one? Because after all, the jury set the million.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that once the court considered the post-verdict motions and adjusted the compensatory damages, it should have conducted the same review which this court has commanded that it conduct. And at that point, it should have been reviewing the question of the compensatory damages, which the trial court itself found to be reasonable and fair, versus the punitive damage
award. Wasn't there a dispute as to whether there was not a timely motion? I know that's not before the court. Okay.
Yes, there is, Your Honor. There was a dispute about that.
Okay. But we have jurisdiction to deal with this anyway, and this is de novo review, right?
It is de novo review. The court has jurisdiction. We've cited the cases about jurisdiction.
All right. So we can decide whether we're going to use 29,000 or the higher number, right?
Yes, Madam Chief Justice. This will be the first de novo review of this case that has been conducted. Trial court refused to do so. The appeals court refused to do so also. First American submits to this court that the court should strike the punitive damage award in its entirety because all of it is grossly excessive. There is not $1 that should be paid by First American as punitive damages. Let me remind the court of its holdings in Jacques versus Steinberg Homes. The case was about intentional trespass onto someone's property. This court said in paragraph 21, this court has long recognized every person's constitutional right to the exclusive enjoyment of his own property for any purpose which does not evade the rights of another person. The court went on to say that this would be a hollow right if it could not be enforced. Then the court quoted an interesting letter that a commentator had offered, a letter that a property owner could offer to the world. To the world, keep off my property unless you have my permission, which I may grant or withhold. Signed, private citizen. The court said that a letter of that sort should be enforced because it is very important for a person to be able to exclude the world from his property. The court went on to say that the potential for harm resulting from the intentional trespass on property supports an exception to certain cases that would otherwise...
Counsel?
Yes.
Does bad faith by an insurance company support punitive damages? Generally, as a matter of law.
Not a finding of bad faith, Your Honor, no.
Pardon me?
Not a finding of bad faith.
Okay, is it your position that never can there be punitive damages against an insurance company on a finding of bad faith?
No, Your Honor, that's not my position.
So it could be here. Okay.
It could be here.
All right. What distinguishes this from other cases in which bad faith does support punitive damages?
I complete my analogy to Jacques, Madam Chief Justice. I think I can answer your question.
All right.
In Jacques, this court found that one intentional trespass on property one time supported a punitive damage award against the trespasser of 100,000-1. Because there, as this court said, society has an interest in punishing and deterring intentional trespassers beyond that of the mere individual who owns the property. It said private landowners should feel confident that wrongdoers who trespass upon their land will be appropriately punished. In this case, that letter that I just read to the world was sent by the neighboring landowner, Land Concepts, to the insureds, the Kimballs. Land Concepts said, don't come on my property anymore. The Kimballs and the Stevensons, who bought their claims, had built a driveway on Land Concepts' property. It trespassed. That fact is not in dispute. In fact, the Kimballs filed this lawsuit in order to claim a prescriptive easement to use the driveway because there was no right to use it. But they received that letter in March of 2009 from Land Concepts. Their claim before this court and as to First American is that First American, their title insurer, should have helped them. What they are really saying is that this court should find that First American should be fined $1 million because it did not help them in their intentional continued trespass on their neighbor's land.
I didn't think that's what they were saying. I thought what they were saying is that the fact that they didn't have legal access to the property and apparently no longer permissive access was something that First American knew when they reviewed the claim that was brought to First American under the title policy, but First American shut their eyes to their claim and asserted somehow there was access, even though there was no legal access. I thought that's what they were talking about.
Justice, you raise a good point in that there has been confusion on this issue. This is why we have included several maps with our briefs. There are four ways to get to this property. There's a plat.
Are there any legal access routes without the subsequent purchase of this right of easement over the neighbor's property?
Yes, Justice, there are. There are two recorded easements. One is to the west, across Land Concepts' own land, and the other is to the north. That was granted in 1956 and again in 1959. There, no court has ever ruled that those easements have been extinguished. No court has ever ruled that they've been abandoned. And no court has ever said that they've been voluntarily terminated.
What was the compensatory damages for?
It was attorney's fees that the Kimballs incurred in the prosecution of the lawsuit to assert not their right to use the recorded easements, but the right to use the trespassing driveway, which they believed had ripened into a prescriptive easement right. So by nature, then, it was not the right to use, which they held. And this is then like Jacques, in that Steinberg Holmes and Jacques said, we don't want to use the road, the legal right. We want to use the easier path, and we just want to go across your property. And this court punished it. So what the trial court did in permitting the million-dollar award against First American was to find in a circuitous way that First American had failed to assist its insureds in the continued conduct which this court has already condemned as being subject to a punitive damage award.
Who was liable for the compensatory damages in this case?
May I ask again, who is liable?
Yeah. Was a judgment taken out against for the compensatory damages?
The only judgment is against First American Title. And that
okay.
Is,
and that's not before the court, right?
The
compensatory damages are not before the court. There is a good judgment against American Title, right?
First American Title, yes.
First American Title Insurance Company for compensatory damages. We're not going to fight that battle again. The court drafted a limiting order, right? So you got compensatory damages under First American. I'm assuming that the compensatory damages is a contract damage because you had a contract with Kimball, right?
Yes.
All right. And in addition to the contract damages, you got punitive damages, right?
Yes.
And we agree that bad faith contract damages, right?
Yes.
Can under certain circumstances, support punitive. And the
yes.
fight is not about can they support Amir, but how much. Is that right? Maybe I'm wrong.
Chief Justice, I believe that this court should find that no punitive damages are awardable in this case for the simple reason that punitive damages are not compensatory, as the court has said. There has to be a review of the facts in order to determine if any award is justified. That there is a justification for such an award if a legitimate interest that the state protects has been violated. The punitive damage award, then, is the means by which society punishes the wrongdoer. So the first step is there reprehensible conduct by the defendant that would actually cause it to be subject to punitive damages?
In order to get to your argument, though, I would have to go back and relook at whether there was bad faith here. Because if, in fact, the bad faith is a tort, okay? So what they're saying is you got a contract claim under the title policy, but you knew that there was a lawful claim here, and you stalled or you did a lot of things that you shouldn't do, which are outside of the contract. So now we're into a tort claim. So in order to say there is no right of punitive damages here, I also have to say that there wasn't bad faith here, wouldn't I?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
I think so.
But
okay.
In any event, in order to assess the punitive damage claim and to weigh it against the Constitution as a deprivation of property rights or a possible deprivation, the court has to consider the facts of the case. And so it has to consider all of the facts of the case. It has to resift the evidence in order to figure out if there was a legitimate state interest to be protected, if there was adequate notice to the world of that state interest that was to be protected, and the damage that could be assessable against First American Title for having violated that legitimate interest, and if, in fact, there was the reprehensible conduct by First American Title that would show that it needed to be punished for what it did and that others need to be deterred from what First American did. And so in order to assess all of that, the court must go back and review the facts. That, to me, is exactly what de novo review means.
Mr. Bushnell, let me take this a little further. Are you asking the court to find that Judge Ehlers never should have submitted a question in regard to punitive damages? Is that what you're arguing to us?
I believe that that is correct, Your Honor, because this court has said that trial courts are to review those questions in advance to determine whether or not they should be submitted to the jury. But in any event, what I know for sure is that this court has ordered the trial court to review, make a de novo review after a punitive damage verdict has been entered to see if the defendant's constitutional rights have been violated. That part we know he did not do.
When you look at the issue that this court crafted and asked the attorneys to address, I would expect that what you would do is take the case of Tower Insurance Company, and you would look at the six factors that were set forth in Tower Insurance, and that your argument would zero in or focus, if you will, on those six factors, rather than on whether or not there should have been a punitive damage question in the jury verdict. So I'm a little bit surprised, and I suspect some of my colleagues may be a little surprised by the arguments you're giving us today. Do you think that the Tower Insurance factors are the ones you should be talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And you think you're doing that by talking about the grievousness of the acts of First American?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is the first and most important element, the reprehensibility of the conduct. In discussing Jack, my point is simply this, that what the insured was asking this insurer to do was to help them do something, which this court has said is not even proper. The title insurance policy ensures that there is good title to the property and that there is a right of access to the property. This case has never determined, and no court has ever determined, that the actual legal right of access to this property, by what I have referred to as the North Easement, is invalid, abandoned, or has been voluntarily terminated. There is a right of access to this property. Mrs. Kimball at trial testified that she looked at the property and looked at the old path of the driveway, which they had ceased to use when they decided to make the cutoff road so that they no longer used the easement that had been granted. But the trial court never found that the north easement no longer existed.
Well, let me ask you this. What other factors set forth in Tower Insurance do you think are appropriate for this court to be focusing on in deciding whether or not the $1 million punitive damage award was an appropriate one?
Thank you. Well, let me say first what obviously is not an appropriate factor. There was no physical injury here. And so because this is an insurance case, the damages are purely economic, then this court must consider primarily the maliciousness of the defendant, which in cases of insurance bad faith, this court has said, come down to evidence of evil intent deserving of punishment, special ill will toward the insured, or that the insurer acted with wanton disregard of its duty, or that its conduct was gross or outrageous. That comes from Anderson at page 697. Those are the factors, then, interpreted in the case of an insurance bad faith claim as to a punitive damage award. So there has to be not just the showing that an insurer denied coverage for a reason that was less than fairly debatable, but that there was special ill will or wantonness type factor exists. Here's what I submit are the undisputed facts. Policy ensures a right of access. There is one. There's a recorded easement. It has never gone away. It has never been abandoned.
Counsel, I'm sorry, but this court crafted a order in response to your petition for review. Your petition for review had what you're arguing now as issue number one, but we didn't accept that for review. So,
I mean,
you've got four issues. We crafted our own issue. As you know, I objected to the form. But there's an issue, and it's not issue number one or not issue number three about expert testimony, or it's in one is ensuring access stuff. And it's not number four. It's the one that this court presented.
So I'm sorry that I am frustrating the justice, and I do understand. This is an issue about the manner in which this court conducts its review. This court is looking for the ill will or the wanton disregard of the insured's rights that would justify a punitive damage award.
Well, perhaps, and maybe that goes to the form of the question. I don't know if what all seven members may have been thinking, or six members, excuse me, if it was a matter of assuming that there is entitlement as the jury determined that there is entitlement to punitive damages, then whether the million punitive damages award against First American violates the Wisconsin Constitution or the common law of the state of Wisconsin, or I'm not sure if the court intended that, is there any entitlement at all? And that's what you seem to be addressing, not the dollar amount, but is there any entitlement to punitive damages at all?
Justice, if I may answer this way, the court does have to find reprehensible conduct, and then it has to judge how bad was it, how evil was it. Mm-hmm. I am trying to explain the actual conduct based on undisputed fact. I suggest that there is no evidence of evil will toward the insured or active malice toward the insured. This is a very high ratio, 33-1 or 20-1.
And that's the issue that I suggest you address.
Thank you.
That is exactly the issue, the ratio. The assumption has to be here the jury found that you violated the contract. The jury found bad faith. The jury thought punitive damages were to be awarded. The issue is whether it's $1 million. Now, I agree with Justice Brantley that the question asked is not good form. But I suggest that you've got 5 minutes left of your argument and that you address the numbers.
Thank you.
But you don't have to take that as a friendly suggestion.
Thank you. This court would look to whether or not there is potential harm beyond the $29,000 or of compensatory damages. I have suggested in our briefs exactly why there is no potential for harm to the Kimballs beyond that number. First, I don't think that the Stevensons, who bought the Kimballs' claims, really stand in the shoes of the Kimballs as to their potential harm. I can sell my insurance claim, but I cannot sell the harm that I might face as an individual. But in any event, that harm, if there was any that the court could find, would have to be the amount of money that was paid to actually buy the easement that cured the trespass. That amount was $40,000. That was paid by the Stevensons. The Kimballs did not pay it. But even if the court takes the money paid by the Stevensons and adds it to the $29,000, that's $70,000 roughly. That's a 14-to-1 ratio. So there is no potential harm that justifies an award in this amount. Also, the Stevensons have argued now that there was the possibility of an extortionate demand by Land Concepts for a granting of an easement. This court said in Jacques that it's enough to say, I don't want to give you an easement. Is it possible to say that someone could extort money in order to grant a right to someone who is using something that they own without right? I don't think it's extortionate, but in any event, if the court considers it, that's the total, the $40,000. The Stevensons also asked this court to use as an offset to decrease the ratio, the value of the home. Stevensons don't own the home. This is the home owned by the Kimballs. But a home is not harm. It is not even the potential for harm. It might have been possible to argue that there could be a decrease in the value of the house if someone was threatening you with the inability to get to your property. There was another way to get to this property. They wanted to use the driveway as it existed.
What did they ultimately sell the house for?
Your Honor, I heard
later
that
record,
it was...
If it's in the record, please.
It's not in the record.
Did they sell the house? Is that in the record?
No.
Can I find that in the Register of Deeds when it was sold?
Yes, Your Honor.
Public record, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'll look at it. And it'll have tax transfer stamps?
Yes.
And that'll show the price, right?
That's right.
Okay. That's public open record, right?
Yes.
No debate on facts?
No.
Okay. Counsel, your red light is on. And I'm going to leave you with a 2014 view of the case. One, in the civil law, we have rules of forfeiture and waiver. And you didn't preserve your right on a judgment notwithstanding the verdict here because your motion wasn't filed timely. In the criminal law, we have a case called Escalona. And if you don't put in all of your objections and you don't put them in the first time you can do it, they are gone. The criminal defendant can sit in prison. Gone. And that stops litigation and fosters everybody to do everything at one time. And I'm thinking of a civil Escalona. So think about that. Number two, I want to know about whether or not when we consider compensatory damages, I want to know compensatory damages that are not compensated under the law, like emotional distress in this contract case, right? There'd be significant emotional distress in my house if we had an offer of $1.5 million or $3.5 million and couldn't take it because there seemed to be a defect and the title insurance company had insured against this defect and were not coming forth. And I don't know that all other expenses, out-of-pocket expenses that I'd have in all this litigation are compensated in the $29,000. And the Stevenson and others have put in about $50,000 to clean this mess up, right? So we're from $50,000 to $29,000, $30,000, we're really at $80,000. And I don't know if they really compensate for all the damages, just compensation for damages recognized by law, which is not full compensation for damages. And so if you're going to start into whether this is 1, 2, or 9, and max is, let's say the max is 10, I can get these damages up to $100,000 quite easily. And then you got a 9 to 1 or 10 to 1 ratio. So think about that. And I would like you to be prepared to respond to that on your rebuttal, and I'm going to ask Mr. Weber to think about that and to respond to those in his argument. Thank you, Mr. Nielsen.
Before you sit down, given the
Justice Rogensack has a question,
asking you about emotional harm, as you're thinking about that, it would be helpful for the court to be reminded whether that was ever part of the verdict that the jury was asked to find.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Friedman?
Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm James Friedman from Godfrey & Kahn. We represent the three amici in this case, the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, the Wisconsin Civil Justice Council, and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. I'd first like to thank the court for the opportunity to participate in this appeal, and to thank both the court and First American Title for the opportunity to participate in this argument. As we did in our brief, I plan to focus on the standard of review and the process for review required by both the U.S. and Wisconsin constitutions for excessive awards of punitive damages, and the reasons or the policies behind that, quote, exacting review, to quote the U.S. Supreme Court, and why that's critical to businesses in Wisconsin. The U.S. Supreme Court has mandated de novo review of punitive damage awards challenged as excessive. It's appropriate to defer to fact finders with respect to the underlying facts behind the punitive damage awards, but there is no deference paid to the magnitude of that award. And this court needs to confirm that standard applies.
Would you repeat that? I want to make sure I heard that. I heard you say, I think, that we are to defer to the fact that punitive damages was awarded, but not to the amount?
No, I'm sorry, Justice Breyer. I was confusing. There are facts that are found by a jury that underlie a punitive damage award. What happened? What reprehensible or allegedly reprehensible conduct occurred here? And certainly the fact finder deserves great deference on that fact finding. But a jury does not deserve any deference on the magnitude of a punitive damage award.
That's what I thought. Thank you very much.
And it's obvious why that's the case. Jurors cannot be expected to understand and apply constitutional limitations to awards of punitive damages. Punitive damages are intended to punish the wrongdoer. They do not compensate the plaintiff. The problem is that they come about in civil lawsuits where the same protections that are available in criminal cases aren't available. So it's critical that the reviewing court, whether it's the trial court or appellate courts, provide that level of protection and harmonize punitive damage awards so that the same conduct in one case doesn't result in a $100 award of punitive damages and in another case a $1 million award. That's simply not consistent with due process.
Well, it is if the conduct is different.
I said if the conduct was the same, Chief Justice.
Okay. All right.
And unfortunately,
Mr.
the trial
Freeman,
court...
Let me interrupt you for a minute. In this particular case, you've got a finding by the circuit judge on motions after verdict of about $29,700 in compensatory damages. What is the position of the folks that you represent in regard to how that should be looked at in comparison with a $1 million punitive damages award? In other words, what is your suggestion as to how we should approach on a de novo review whether or not the $1 million punitive damages award is appropriate given the amount of compensatory damages?
In general, I think it's critical that this court make it clear that plaintiffs can't just pick and choose numbers out of thin air. The value of the house was never part of the equation. The house was never, no one ever said the house is worth zero without this drive. And yet, you know, the plaintiffs threw out the value of the house. And the limits of the insurance policy, totally irrelevant. It doesn't matter if there's a $370,000 limits or $1 million limits because those numbers never came into play. It's critical for notice that people understand what number a court is going to be reviewing and what ratio a court will be reviewing. And Justice Crooks, I think in this court, as Mr. Nielsen stated, there are only two potentially relevant numbers. One is the actual judgment amount. So there's a jury award of $50,000. The judge remits that down to $29,000 and change. That's probably the appropriate award, and in 99% of cases, that is going to be the appropriate award. This is an unusual case because the party that was harmed initially, the Kimballs, are allegedly harmed. They're not even involved at the time of the jury verdict. So there is another number that I do think is potentially appropriate here, and that's the settlement amount. That's the $40,000 that was paid for the easement. So a fairly modest amount was paid to resolve the whole ball of wax. The $29,000 is really attorney's fees. And in a bad faith case, this court has stated attorney's fees, you know, can be shifted. Those are the only relevant numbers. And it doesn't matter how whether you take one, the other, or add them together, you're at a multiple that is in excess of what the U.S. Supreme Court has said on multiple occasions is really the max.
Please. The question that was presented was whether the $1 million punitive damages award against First American Title Insurance Company violates the Wisconsin Constitution or common law of the state of Wisconsin. So far, I've just heard you refer to the case law of the United States Supreme Court. So do you have any case law with regard to the Wisconsin Constitution or the common law of the state of Wisconsin?
Yeah, certainly, Justice Bradley. I think I'd start by pointing out that this court consistently for decades now has said that due process protections under the state constitution are parallel to those under the federal constitution. And so I do think for that reason, and because whether it's this case or some other, and I'm not going to get into arguments about waiver, but the U.S. constitutional due process protections have to apply in Wisconsin courts with respect to punitive damages as well. But this court certainly has accepted.
Civil law and criminal law, you think they're exactly the same?
I'm sorry, what?
Both in civil, because the cases are generally criminal law Fourth Amendment cases you're talking about.
In terms of due process? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not referring to any criminal law cases, whether it's the U.S. Supreme Court cases, you know, BMW versus Gore and Campbell and State Farm, or whether it's this court's, you know, Trinity or other cases. Those are the ones I'm referring to. It's the same constitutional provision, but the application is very different in civil versus criminal. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why the exacting review is necessary, because you don't have the same process in a civil case that you do as a defendant in a criminal case.
Mr. Friedman, since we've gone way beyond your red light already, I'd like to just ask you one question, because I think other counsel will have the opportunity to address this, and I have a funny feeling I know what they'll both say, but I'd like your spin on the Chief Justice's question that she asked at the end of Mr. Nielsen's presentation, and that really was, if you're not being compensated in the underlying lawsuit for breach of contract and bad faith for the kinds of other damages that really it'd be nice if you had that claim, but it's just not available in the law, should you be compensated for those damages you can't otherwise claim in those kinds of actions in the form of punitive damages. Should we be making punitive damages more of a compensatory damages analysis, I think, is the bottom line of what the Chief Justice was asking.
And I think the answer is clearly no, and it's no for due process reasons, because you can't have notice of, well, there's a potential for this, and maybe you could get that. In this case, you've got a judgment, and you've got a settlement amount, and from a matter a notice purpose under the due process clauses of the constitutions, those are the numbers that should be used. Courts should not pick numbers out of thin air. No one received any money for the other types of compensation the Chief Justice identified, because nobody apparently felt it was appropriate in this case.
You can't get them under the law in Wisconsin. You just couldn't get it. The question, though, is reasonableness of the punitive damages, and you look at in terms of what this person suffered. And I don't know that there's a case that says to look at the reasonableness, you only look at not only what they suffered, but only what the law would compensate them for. Not what the law recognizes they suffer, but that the law won't compensate. Let me just, your light's on, but you and Mr. Nielsen differ. I hear you saying that the only two relevant numbers are the jury verdict, which either can take 50 or 29. You would say take 29. And the second relevant number is the settlement issue, which was 40,000. And with I don't know whether you take the 10. But what you're up to then is not 29,000, but you're up to, even accepting your figure, 70. And you can even go up to 80 if you take the $10,000 in. And the general rule is single digit. I mean, if you're going to make a general rule, single digit. So 9 times 70 would be how much?
$630,000.
Okay. And so if the jury had awarded $630,000, would you be here?
Absolutely, Chief Justice. That would be far in excess of what's appropriate in this case. Again, because you look at the reprehensibility, this is not sexual assault. This is not drunk driving. This is a fair, with all due respect to the parties, this is a fairly mundane insurance contract and easement case. This is not a case where you get to the limit. And I'd also point out the U.S. Supreme Court on multiple occasions has said 4-1 is about as far as you should go. So now even when you're, if you added those two numbers together, you're down substantially from the number you just threw out.
Up to about $300,000.
Which again would be in excess of what our legislature has now said is the maximum going forward of $200,000.
Well, they said what was awarded or $200,000. That's the maximum.
Right. So in this case, if you doubled the 69, you'd get, you know, 138 or 200. 200 would be the higher of the two. So 200 would be an absolute max under the law. U.S. Supreme Court has said courts must defer to legislatures when they do, in fact,
statute's not applicable to this case, is it?
No, but I think the court still should show some deference to the legislature's decision in that regard.
Well, the legislature showed deference to the court by saying it only applies in the future and not to this case. So we should show deference to the legislature by not applying the law to this case. That's another argument, not one you would make.
No. Right. I would show deference. Thank you.
Mr. Weber.
May it please the court. This case really involves two separate issues. First, whether First American Title Insurance Company should be relieved from its failure to timely file its post-verdict motions and be allowed to present this appeal on the punitive damages. And I would submit under Section 805.16 in the recently decided Northern Air Services versus Link case that it should not. The second issue, of course, is the one the court accepted for on the punitive damage award. And with respect to that, with the court's indulgence, I'd like to jump right into that second issue. But I would like to come back to the first, even though it's procedural. I perceive the court's questions more directed towards the substantive issue, and I'm going to take that direction and proceed in that way.
Counsel, as you address that, will you tie in the Chief Justice's question regarding should a punitive damages award include compensatory damages that weren't otherwise available in the underlying lawsuit, claimed or unclaimed, awarded or not awarded, and should punitive damages really be another way to award compensatory damages?
I will address that, Your Honor, from my perspective. To first address the standard of review in this on this issue, I would agree with the petitioner that it's de novo. However, the court has stated repeatedly that only when the award is grossly excessive would it consider to disturb that award. The evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict, and constitutionally found facts are owed that constitutional deference. The respondents have a constitutional interest in this case as well, and that is in the sanctity of those jury's findings. The policy in this case provided two different types of coverage that applied, one for lack of access, two for unmarketable title. There are six key constitutional facts that I submit show why this verdict should be affirmed. And they all go towards the reprehensible nature of the First American Title Insurance Company's conduct, to borrow a word from the BMW case, or the egregiousness of their conduct, to borrow a word from our jury instruction in this state. First, they had the March 5th, 2008 letter written by Land Concepts. That letter was emphatic and clear, and it was written to the realtor. It said that they had no access and they could not convey any access to the highway. It was explicit in that respect, and it wasn't just an informal letter or statement made by a neighbor, but rather a formal letter written to the realtor to have the express purpose of making this property unmarketable, and that's what in fact occurred. They also had another thing. They had the Coffrin deed. This is a deed from 1955 that actually showed there could be no access granted through the easement referenced in two deeds to the predecessors of the Kimballs. Two warranty deeds going back to 1956 and 1959 stated that the property was being conveyed with a right of access through the north. Mr. Schenker, once the file was discovered, it was learned that he knew that the Coffrin deed existed from 1955 and prevented that access route from having been granted in 1956 and 59. The predecessors entitled did not have the right to convey it. The third key fact, First American's agent suggested that further inquiry would be warranted in this situation and presented the precise question on coverage to Mr. Schenker on March 25th, 2008. She did that in an email late on a Friday evening, and she questioned, does this mean that the easement granted in 1956 and 59 is invalid? Question mark. She left that to Mr. Schenker, who was for 18 years an assistant vice president of the company. For 15 years he'd been handling claims, and he was handling this claim. It had been presented to him, and he was reviewing that.
Counsel, to harken back to what Justice Bradley's done a couple of times now, the facts are important. They're how the jury reached its verdict. But the compensatory damages that were awarded, do you quarrel with the amount that was awarded and what the judge did later? I mean, the real question is, how does the punitive damages relate to that? Unless what you're arguing is what the Chief Justice was suggesting, and that's, you know, that somehow punitive damages have now been changed and they really are a form of compensatory damages.
Your Honor, I think that this Court has stated on several occasions, and most recently in the Trinity case, that the egregiousness of the conduct is the most important factor. And when we're looking at the fact that there is no mathematical formula in this state, and that this Court has also said that on several occasions, not most recently in the Trinity case 20 years earlier in a case in which it explained exactly why that shouldn't be done in the Faumberg and versus Tingle case. And in that case, the Supreme Court, this Court, stated that the jury should consider not only the actual compensatory damages awarded, but should consider the potential harm to the insured in this situation. And that's found right in our jury instruction, 17 1201.
Counselor, just so I'm not misunderstanding your answer, Justice Ziegler said, do you quarrel with the amount of compensatory damages? And now you begin to talk about potential harm. I am taking your answer as saying, yes, you are quarreling with the amount of compensatory damages. So if I'm wrong, would you straighten me out sooner rather than later?
Yes. Okay. That is not my position.
Okay.
I was addressing the prospect of how to calculate the what should be taken into account. And I think it's very clear that potential harm should be. With respect to the compensatory damages reduction, we haven't cross-appealed that. We didn't take issue with the judge reducing it to the number of almost $30,000 from $50,000. We did submit to the jury that the compensatory damages that should be awarded here were higher than $29,000. The $29,000 figure was for attorney's fees and surveyor expenses only.
But Counselor, you're not trying to stick compensatory damages into the punitive damages. That's what I want to square in my own mind.
I'm sorry. I am trying to do that in terms of what should be considered in terms of a ratio. It should be both the compensatory damages and that were actually awarded and the potential compensatory damages.
Okay. So what you're trying to do is expand compensatory damages by the amount of punitive damages. I don't know any case that ever says you can do that.
I'm not sure that that's what I'm intending to say, Judge. I must.
Okay.
Justice,
all right. Because I'm really confused by your answer because her question to you was straightforward. Do you quarrel with the amount of compensatory damages? And then you started talking about potential harm. Well, there wasn't any compensatory damages given for potential harm. So then I wanted, because I took your answer as yes, you're sticking potential harm into punitive damages, which means you're trying to expand compensatory damages, but now you say you're not. So I'm still a little off base, if you can help me get straightened out here.
Maybe I can help you since I started.
I'd like to help me. Thank you.
Well, you can help me, too. The point is, are you going to make the ratio with compensatory damages, which is 29 grand here, or are you asking the court to make a ratio considering... And what you did is, I'm sorry, I've forgotten the adjective you used, potential harm, potential damages.
I'm asking the court to use, in considering a ratio,
right,
both the compensatory damages and the potential
That's
damages.
What I thought your answer was going
I
to
thought
be.
You didn't want a ratio. What's the ratio that you want?
I'm not advocating for any mathematical formula.
That's what I heard you. I heard you say when you're considering punitive damages, you consider the harm that happened to this person, regardless of, I mean, so long as you have a dollar, you can get punitive damages. So consider what happened, the harm to this person, even though we couldn't claim that. It couldn't be awarded. It wasn't awarded, and it wasn't part of a compensatory damage claim. We didn't get money for that, so give it to us as part of punitive damages. That's what I'm hearing you say. Is that right? The harm that was caused to us, award that in the form of punitive damages. Yes or no?
I don't think that I'm saying that,
okay.
Justice Ziegler. What I'm advocating is no mathematical formula, but having understood that the Supreme Court has suggested that a single-digit multiplier that takes into account potential damages is one factor for the court to consider in determining whether there's a grossly excessive award here.
When you say potential damages, what do you mean?
What I mean by
compensatory or punitive?
What I mean by that is neither. What I mean by that is that harm that the insured could have faced if the insurer would have been allowed to do what it did and nothing else would have come in between. Let me take the Trinity case as a perfect example of this. Here you had a church that was insured in a car accident matter with a coverage dispute where the insurer denied coverage. As soon as that church was sued, it was actually provided counsel by Tower, and it had counsel from the start of that litigation, but the insurer denied coverage and separately moved, filed a lawsuit for declaratory judgment and actually made a motion for summary judgment asking that the policy, as wrongly stated, be enforced. What the court found in that case is that if the insurer would have been successful in having that policy, which was wrong, validated and used in that case involving its insured, the insureds would have faced almost $500,000 in loss because that was the loss they faced in the car accident case. So though the insured could never and was never actually facing a judgment of almost $500,000, it would have if it had not been covered and if the insured hadn't been allowed to get things straightened out by the time the bad faith.
A traditional bad faith claim.
Right. And I think the same thing applies here, Your Honor, where, in fact, my client, all right, is trying to sell a house in March of 2008 and has no access, has no ability to convey access, and has been told that in an actual writing to their realtor. They didn't have the ability to sell their house at that time. And they could have, when they came home from church one afternoon and they had cement posts installed on both sides of their driveway, they were facing threatened closure of that access. There was a potential harm to my clients that was very high. And it's wrong for my opponent to argue that there was no facts in the record to show why we would be seeking a potential damage amount of in excess of almost $400,000. The policy limit here was $370,000 because the policy had been issued on a different home when the Kimballs purchased. When Mr. Schenker was asked the question, what were your options under this title insurance policy if there was no access? And he testified there were three options. Number one, he could start litigation and try to establish access. Number two, he could buy access and from the land concepts. Or number three, they could pay and walk. Now, with the proof that land concepts, just as my opponent has argued, was refusing to sell any access to the Kimballs, the prospect of them having a virtually worthless piece of property was actually real. And Mr. Schenker admitted in his testimony that that he may well have had to pay and walk, and that this was a potentially very big claim on the policy. So there is very good evidence in the record about the size and potential of the loss to my clients. And when I'm talking about potential harm, I'm referring to that harm that the insured faced because the insurer left them in a situation of without coverage in bad faith.
Mr. Weber, let me go back to the case you mentioned a few minutes ago, the Tower Insurance case. One of the main factors discussed in that case is whether the award of punitive damages bears a reasonable relationship to the award of compensatory damages. What's your answer to that?
Your Honor.
And on what basis do you arrive at that answer?
Sure. In the same way that Trinity handled that issue, which was to consider in conjunction with the actual compensatory damages awarded in that case of only $17,000 for attorney's fees, this court took into account the $470,000 or $490,000 that the insured faced without coverage. In that sense, Trinity faced a 7-to-1 ratio in its $3.5 million verdict, and the court found that that was within reason and it could be constitutionally accepted. And therefore, the verdict was not disturbed. That same analysis applies here with respect to the way we presented to the jury when we talked about the potential and actual harm that our client faced. To go back to Chief Justice Abraham's question about what are the categories of the harm that could be considered, we sought to include in that potential harm number the additional mortgage interest and taxes, real estate taxes that were paid because my client was stuck owning this very expensive home for years following the failure by First American and the loss of the $1.3 million sale to the Mueller's. We included, along with our claim, the actual, as I indicated before, in a chart, and it included the potential loss of up to the policy limits. If, in fact, Land Concepts was successful in closing these people off, that was their real potential harm. And those factors should be taken into account. Getting back to the
do you think the 7-to-1 ratio in Tower Insurance was a fair and appropriate one, looking at compensatory damages and then punitive damages?
Absolutely it was.
Why wouldn't it be fair here?
I see no way to distinguish that case from this one, Your Honor. I don't think that this court wants to give litigants and courts in this state the idea that whether a punitive damage verdict or not should be affirmed or considered to be grossly excessive depends on what the court had for breakfast in the morning, to coin a phrase from my colleague in one of his briefs to the court when we're talking about another issue. What the petitioners are arguing for in truth with respect to these issues, respectfully, is a number of improper and failures with respect to the proper boundaries of not only the court, the clerk's office, in blaming the clerk for possibly negligently stamping a document, in blaming this court clerk for the way the clerk uses the word submit in the CCAP entry. We're hearing arguments that this court should apply the legislator's new law on capping punitive damages, even though it specifically states when the law becomes effective, as if this court should override the legislature's intent in that respect. There are arguments pervading this appeal that would invite this court to take activist roles in each of these issues in terms of re-legislating everything, changing the standards from how it determines when to consider the failure to timely file a post-verdict motion in terms of whether to grant relief to a party that says that they have a manifest injustice when there's no meaningful way to distinguish this case from the Link case.
Well, your opposing counsel are saying that the award of punitive damages here amounted to a ratio of 33-1, looking at the reduction by Judge Ehlers to $29,700 as against $1 million. Can you justify that? Do you think the 33-1 ratio is reasonable, looking at compensatory as against punitive damages?
I do think it's reasonable if you just look at the actual compensatory damages awarded. And one example of that, and there are cases in which this court has allowed for ratios of that and even higher to stand when we're talking about $1 million, given the other factors involved. If we have egregious conduct, if we've got malicious conduct, which existed in this case with great evidence, if you have a verdict that meets the other factors, and just that one is less than what you might prefer to see in terms of a higher ratio, I think it's sustainable. We have other cases in this state. Council mentioned one with a trespass case. That was 100,001. We have the Walton versus Monumental case. That's a 26-1 ratio. We've cited other cases in our briefing that do show other large ratios. But when we take a look at the potential damages, which is also another factor referenced in Trinity, then this becomes a much closer ratio. It's close to, at worst, 2-1, or it could be considered 1-1 when you factor in the true value of what the insurer was facing.
Counsel, you've got six factors in Trinity or Tower, whatever name you want to give to the case. And how do, following up on Justice Crooks's question, when you employ those six factors that Tower Trinity told us to look at, how do you justify this award?
I justify it primarily on the egregiousness of the conduct and the reprehensible nature of First American. And I got through a couple of the factors that I think that the facts that are in this record and that the jury found. And I strongly disagree with my counsel's argument that Judge Ehlers did not review this punitive damage award. He clearly did. When he reviewed it, he found that the jury had found Mr. Schenker's conduct had been reprehensible and that the $1 million nature of this home and the loss of the $1.3 million sale, when you factored all that in, he found no problem whatsoever with this punitive damage award. That is a review. He did understand that there would be a de novo review on appeal, but Judge Ehlers did consider this verdict. He went through each of the issues raised by the petitioner one by one in his hearing and decision-making, and there was a review. It was a review that considered the very reprehensible nature of this conduct by First American, and which they still present here today by arguing that there was access to this property that existed. They take the same position in a very similar way as in the Trinity versus Tower Insurance Company case, which I listened to the oral argument in that case from almost 10 years ago to prepare for today. And Tower's lawyer stood before this court and argued that the insurance company should have been allowed to proceed to court, seek judicial determination on whether the contract should be reformed, even in oral argument to this court. Though this court had earlier decided that when the facts were as they were in that case, they had a duty to reform it on their own. This court did not accept that argument that was presented that day, and neither should this court accept the counterarguments that there is legal access to this property in other areas where there clearly isn't. There's been findings of fact on that by the judge. There's been findings on that by the Court of Appeals that took a look at each of the arguments made by First American and showed why they weren't valid. We have presented the proof on that. There's no way to show that our client had any access. Not only did they not have actual access, there was apparently no access, and there was an alleged no access, which are, when you look at the way unmarketable title is defined in the policy of a First American, it includes both alleged lack of access and apparent lack of access. So these defects were present repeatedly in presented to First American. And despite the suggestion that further inquiry be made, Mr. Shanker decided not to do that. On the very next day, the very next business day, he sent out a letter to the Kimball's lawyer, which basically laid out a pretty thorough brief on why there was this route of access to the north by virtue of these deeds from 1956 and 1959. What he didn't mention was that he also knew about the Coffrin deed from a year earlier, which prevented that access from being available to him. And he didn't mention anything about the Coffrin deed. And he...
Counsel, I want to put you into another topic for a moment, okay? We can go. You're dealing with how egregious this is, and marketable title. And, all right. How much in compensatory damages was there in Trinity?
$17,000.
But the potential was much higher.
The potential was okay. Much higher.
I want to stick with Trinity because I think that's our lead case.
I would agree.
Paragraph 64 says, with regard to the second guidepost, the disparity of harm or potential harm and the punitive damages award, the U.S. Supreme Court recently held, and then there's a cite, there's a quote from Kimball from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes.
Then it says there are no rigid benchmarks, but that it could be that a particularly egregious act resulted in a small amount of economic damages. And then it has some quotes. But the higher ratio might be necessary. This is right from the U.S. Supreme Court. Where the injury is hard to detect or the monetary value of non-economic harm might be difficult to determine. So they're recognizing that it's awarded as compensatory damages might not reflect the total potential harm, and then you have to look at the total potential harm. Converse is also true, said the U.S. Supreme Court. When compensatory damages are substantial, then a lesser ratio is the one that should be thought about, right?
I completely agree, Your Honor.
Okay. And that in Trinity, and I'm looking at paragraph 65, Trinity, this is what the court said, introduced evidence of a harm of $490,000. That's the $500,000. Had Tower succeeded, the punitive damages award represents a 7-to-1 ratio to compensatory damages. That's not what was awarded, the $500,000. So that the court is saying, had Trinity prevailed, there would have been damages of $500,000, and therefore punitive damages award was 7-to-1 ratio. They used the $500,000. Trinity used the potential harm And as I read it, didn't it overturn the Court of Appeals and upheld the punitive damages on the grounds of a 7-to-1 ratio on potential harm, not a ratio on actual compensatory damages?
That's exactly
Have
right.
Have I misstated Trinity?
No, you're not. Okay. You're not misstating it. And actually, in Trinity, the trial court had granted summary judgment in favor of the church, finding bad faith. So the jury was not even required to find bad faith. They were impaneled and presented with a case where bad faith has been found as a matter of law. There's a difference between bad faith conduct and a punitive damage award. The jury is fully instructed that just because you find that the insurer is engaged in bad faith doesn't mean the punitive damages necessarily follow. They have the exclusive discretion to determine whether punitive damage should be awarded, and they can only do so if they find that the insurer acted intentionally or with wanton disregard of the rights in a malicious way towards their insured. And this jury was so instructed, and this court presumes that a jury certainly understands those instructions and does not speculate, as the petitioner would ask you to do, that the jury didn't follow those instructions. And specifically with respect to the U.S. Supreme Court, it has gone so far as to approve a case in TXO where the ratio was 526-to-1 if you only considered the actual compensatory damages awarded in that case. There, the U.S. Supreme Court was dealing with a jury verdict where there was only $19,000 in compensatory damages. Again, all attorney's fees. But there was a $10 million punitive damages award, and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld that.
I think that was cited in your brief, if my memory is right, but why don't you give me the citation again to the TXO?
Yes,
was
it is.
Was it cited in your brief?
It is cited in our brief. And
okay, I can find it then. Forget it. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Mr. Weber, when you mentioned TXO, is it fair to note that TXO is decided before the BMW case by the U.S. Supreme Court and also before the Campbell case?
I do think so. I do think so, Justice Crooks. However, the BMW case is another example where you've got a large punitive damage award being affirmed based on smaller compensatory damages. What those courts have said is that it's up to the states largely to determine whether in this situation a award is grossly excessive or should be limited. And specifically, the legislatures of each state are suggested they can certainly adopt policies that would cap punitive damages award if that was to be appropriate. This state has recently decided to do so, but before it did so, it deferred to this court's rulings on the subject. And this court's rulings were very clear that the potential damages should be considered along with the actual damages, and the jury's verdict should be, the court should look and search for evidence in the record to affirm that verdict if it all can. And so in those senses, the U.S. Supreme Court's case law on this has been consistent, I think, and the TXO case is certainly still valid law.
Did they overturn Campbell?
It was not overturned.
Did they overturn TXO?
It was not overturned.
It's sort of the other way around, though. Is it fair to say that when you look at TXO, you look at BMW, and you look at Campbell, that you see sort of a evolution or a progression, if you will, of the thinking of the U.S. Supreme Court in terms of due process?
I believe that the holding of TXO on the subject of the availability of potential damages has remained consistently available. When you talk about the fact that there's no mathematical formula that's to be used, when you talk about potential damages being available to be considered when reviewing the excessiveness of a punitive damage award, those concepts have remained consistent. This court's recent decision in Trinity affirms those concepts. There is no reason to go back on those doctrines at this point. The Wisconsin legislature has made a decision to do so.
Well, doesn't Campbell get to a look at whether or not a single-digit multiplier is generally in accord with due process, and that going beyond a single-digit multiplier has due process implications?
I think you're right, Justice Crux. But when you're looking at that ratio, you should consider also the potential harm. And that's the key to this case, just like it was in Trinity. If Trinity was decided merely on a ratio involving $17,000 for attorney's fees that the church incurred fighting coverage, this court would not have been able to affirm such a large ratio and disparity. At the time Trinity was decided, the BMW case existed. So did the TXO case. I'm sure that this court would have not affirmed the verdict of a $3.5 million award if it only had $17,000 of potential harm to the
insured. I know, but Justice Crooks's question says to me, all right, Trinity says potential harm, reliance on Campbell, TXO, et cetera. They are all still good law. So how do you get to potential harm in this case to justify at a maximum a single-digit nine, at a maximum? Doesn't mean that's fair or reasonable. So I got up to 70 grand. That's what I got up to. What do you get up to?
Well, the easiest way to get up to the number is to look at the testimony of First American Title that they would have paid and walked on this claim had they not been able to show there was illegal access, had they not been able to negotiate with Land Concepts. I would also agree with
Was what, $370,000? That was what their maximum insurance was. Okay.
$370,000.
That's comparable to the $500,000 in Trinity.
Absolutely. And to suggest that the Kimballs, who were selling their house for $1.3 million, might have had to take a loss of $370,000 or more the next time they were able to sell, given what we've all seen happen in the real estate market, it was certainly conceivable that whenever this was solved, if it ever could be solved, they would likely face a huge loss. In the same way, there's no guarantee that Land Concepts would ever allow them to solve this. If Land Concepts wanted to hold out and keep them from ever getting access, they would never have been able to sell that house. Perhaps they would have been cut off from it. First American, in lead up to this trial, suggested that the Kimballs might seek access by water, apparently by boat, to their house. Again, those are the kind of things that when they changed their tune at trial and started presenting a different theory like easement by implication, and they had no evidence to support any of those elements.
Well, if you just use the insurance policy, the title insurance policy with the $370,000, then the $1 million is three times that. That's your number.
That's right, Your Honor. I see that my light is red. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Nielsen, Attorney Nielsen.
I'd like to begin with this question of potential harm that the court is obviously very interested in. In Trinity or Tower, this court said that the harm to the insured that was potential was the harm that the insured faced as a defendant in a lawsuit in which the insurance company had refused to defend. And further, this court found that that insurance company was wrong in the refusal to defend because it knew that the insured had asked for the coverage specifically and that the company was refusing to give it and refusing to amend the policy or reform it to give the coverage that it knew absolutely it had promised to give. Okay. So the insured was being sued. It had the potential for having a money judgment entered against it in excess of policy limits. This court, though, used as the measure of the potential harm to the insured being sued by somebody else as the cost of settling the lawsuit, not the policy limits or the amount in excess of policy limits that it might have been liable for, but the amount that it actually cost to settle the lawsuit, which was the potential for harm. The Kimballs were the plaintiffs. They sued seeking a prescriptive easement because they had no right in the driveway. They did not face potential harm, and counsel continues to refer to the potential harm of the inability to sell. I submit, justices, that you must consider the facts that are in the real estate records, and that would include the easements that had been granted to the Kimballs. They had another option, as our briefs explain. They could have built the driveway back where it used to be and used their legal rights.
How much would that cost?
I'm sorry?
How much would that cost?
We don't know because there was no evidence submitted at trial, but it's about 100 feet long. and that used to be gravel. That was their alternative. They didn't want to do that. They wanted to keep the driveway where it was. They did a cost-benefit analysis and said we'd rather have the driveway where it is.
I want to get back to Trinity for a moment. What was the compensatory damages in Trinity?
I believe the council was right that it was about $17,000.
And the potential harm was $500,000?
Was about $490,000 or $80,000. So the total between the two was about $500,000.
That's where the court got a 7-1 using the $490,000, yes. Not the $17,000 that was actually awarded to them.
It was actually the combination of the two.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But they only got $17,000. In actual money, compensatory damages.
That's correct.
But the court looked at the potential harm.
Yes.
Okay.
In this case, the Stevensons are asking this court to apply some very, very different kind of potential harm.
I understand that, but the concept that you look at potential harm is still there.
But I fully understand that, Chief Justice. Okay. That's why we addressed it. Here are the things that they've listed. The amount of the insurance policy. Now, that was a benefit, not a harm. This court did not look in Trinity at the amount of the policy as a harm. It looked at the cost of settling the lawsuit. They listed the amount of real estate taxes that they paid on the house that they had bought. They listed the amount of principal and interest payments that they made on their mortgage. Okay? Those are not harm, and they don't belong to the Stevensons. They were not even expenses paid by the Stevensons. They have switched their tune on this petition and said that the potential for harm are one of two things. The value of the house itself, which was not lost, and it wasn't even decreased by any proof that they established. And second, they say there was the possibility that Land Concepts might have made an extortionate demand of money in order to grant an easement. That's why I led with Jacques, which says you don't have to give an easement to anybody who's trespassing. Okay. Might Land Concepts have wanted more money than it agreed to accept? Yes, except that what's in the record is that the largest amount they ever asked for was $45,000. The good lawyer for the Kimballs, an excellent lawyer, Gary Wickert, said, I think we can get them to the mid-30s, and they paid 40. But who paid it? The Stevensons, not the Kimballs. The Stevensons stand here clothed in the claim of the Kimballs. The Kimballs did not pay the money, though. That's all elements of potential harm. To answer the Chief Justice's question about potential harm, about other damages claimed, there were no other types of damages claimed in this lawsuit. There was a claim for breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty.
No claim for emotional distress because that wouldn't have been granted under our economic harm doctrine.
That's correct.
But there was emotional distress, I'm sure.
Yes.
And just so I'm clear, none of the damages that were looked at as potential harm in Trinity were speculative because a payment of approximately $490,000 to discharge Trinity's liability had already occurred.
Exactly. And in this case, before this trial occurred, the payment had been made to buy this easement, and the exact amount was owed. The jury was not permitted to hear the amount of that payment because Mr. Weber made a motion in limine which the court granted. So the jury never knew that an easement had been bought, much less how much it had cost.
I know, but we look at it all de novo. We have the whole record. We look at it totally de novo.
I understand.
Right?
If I may, I believe that Mr. Weber misspoke probably because he was standing here. Campbell was reversed, and he talked about BMW as being affirmed. Actually, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the BMW decision.
In what decision, sir?
BMW versus Gore was reversed.
Reversed by what?
By the U.S. Supreme Court. He said that it had been affirmed.
Are you saying that the BMW case was reversed by a subsequent case, or are you saying, as I think I hear you saying, that it reversed the lower court's determination?
The U.S. Supreme Court reversed the lower court's determination.
I know, yes. But BMW is not reversed. The U.S. Supreme Court decision in BMW stands as good law.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And Trinity cites and relies on BMW as good law. and recites and relies on Campbell as good law, and they are good law. Is that correct?
Yes. No, okay. I misunderstood. What I wanted to clarify was that the awards were reversed by those decisions.
I understand, but we nearly had a heart attack here. All right. Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel for an excellent brief and argument on the whole area of punitive damages, which the court looked at very carefully in Trinity, and we review again today under an order that the court issued in this case. And so ends the hearing on 2011-8-15-14, Kimball versus Land Concepts. On behalf of the court, we wish you all season's greetings and a good 2014. The court's oral arguments are now completed as scheduled for the month of December. The court will meet in the conference room at 1:30. We are adjourned.